You're listening to Talk of the Rock. I'm your host, Kayla DeRoche, and today we're having a special conversation about the fire in Chiniac. It's been called the Twin Peaks Fire, I think, right? Yes, it has? Okay. Twin Creeks Fire. It's been called the Twin Creeks Fire. So could you introduce yourselves and then explain how it got that name?
Okay, I'll start out. I'm Amy Kinyzowski. I am the Emergency Services Director for Kodiak. We initially, when we responded to the initial report of the fire, we were referring to it as the Chiniac Fire. Once the Department of Forestry or the Division of Forestry came on scene, they renamed it, or they used the name Twin Creeks Fire, and I would defer to Jim Schwarber as to the process for them naming fires. It's one fire, though.
Okay. Jim, could you introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Jim Schwarber. I'm a public information with the Division of Forestry. I'm working with the Type 3 Incident Management Team that's in place with the division. The incident commander there is Phil Blydenberg, and he's overseeing the operations there of the 90 firefighters that are assigned to this incident.
Okay. And so could you explain more at length what Amy was talking about?
In regards to the naming, there's a straight path on naming that's official, and once that path has been trodden, the name is used nationally and statewide as part of the official fire reporting system. So, unfortunately, we didn't use the one that was already informally being used locally, but it is just one fire, and we've been putting out our announcements to reference that it's also known locally as the Chiniac Fire. But that's the only place, I shouldn't say the only place, but other places in the fire world, it's known by the Twin Creeks Fire, and it also has a fire number 251, I believe, which is another way the fires are referred to, again, in the fire world, for folks that track that closely.
Mm-hmm. So, Amy, could you give us a summary? This fire started on last Thursday night, so could you catch us up until now?
Sure. We got a report at the Kodiak Police Department and the Fire Department that there was a fire burning in the Chiniac area. It was sometime after 9 p.m., probably closer to 9:30. I got the call at 9:30 and headed out to take a look at Dead Man's Curve overlook area. The fire was active. It was raging. It was driven by the wind. You could see it from where we were standing, jumping from treetop to treetop. And so given the conditions, the weather conditions, extreme wind there, very dry conditions, and the fact that what we could see from what we knew was we needed to begin to stand up the emergency management team in the emergency operations center, which I did. We were all up and ready to go just shortly after 10 p.m. Thursday night. We convened in our emergency operations center in the Kodiak Police Department and had about at least 14 people, probably more, were reporting in and taking up their various tasks as we went along. There was a great deal of concern for the residents, for the safety. That's been the focus, and I'm sure that Jim is going to talk about that as well. The focus is the protection of life and the safety of both the residents and the responders was our primary focus. So given what we knew and what we could see, we immediately ordered three buses that had medics attached to them, and one ambulance were sent out the road to Chiniac. We had eyes on the ground out there, and it was reported that the post office area was a safe place to convene. I believe it was a post office. So those folks were out there standing by to evacuate anybody that didn't have transportation out of the area. I did order an evacuation. We also immediately called for the establishment of an emergency shelter, which was at the Kodiak Middle School. We had liaisons from the Kodiak Island Borough School District were in the emergency op center and got right to getting that organized as well. And we established, with the help of the state troopers, we established a roadblock. What we were trying to do was discourage people from going into the fire. There was a lot of debris on the road. We didn't want people to get trapped by going in, nor we wanted to make sure people could get out and then not return until we knew for sure what was happening. I made a formal request to the National Guard to ask the local armory people that are stationed in Kodiak for assistance in keeping that road open and cleared. So they responded and sent out Humvees and folks to work on that. They were very responsive. And then probably most important of all, because of the fire and its volatility in the weather conditions, of course there was volcanic ash in the air as well at that time, so flights certainly wouldn't have been flying then. I made an official request of the State Emergency Operations Center to request wildland firefighter support services, which they were able to assemble and get to us as quickly as possible. So that's kind of what we initially did. We were able to ask all Chiniac residents to please contact us. That we set up a phone number and two people that answered the phone to make sure that they were safe and what their location and number of family members were. We also were tracking the whereabouts of a team of tree planters that were out in the area, as well as three hunters whose a family member had contacted us and was expressing concern about the safety of those hunters and their whereabouts. And then one Chiniac resident whom neighbors hadn't seen in a while, so we were concerned about that, although that individual's house was appeared to be unharmed. So we tracked those folks. And just that initial stand-up and holding the fort until the Division of Forestry, came to Kodiak the next day. We were very fortunate that they were able to come in, and I was just really impressed with the assistance of everybody that came forward. They were more than willing to help, and we were able to minimize property loss as well as loss of life and at least hold things in place until the professional firefighters of these types of fires could arrive in Kodiak.
And, Catherine, you were involved in the Red Cross shelter, is that correct?
Right. My name is Catherine Hollis Buchanan. I'm the disaster action team lead here in Kodiak. We have several active members, and we do drills regularly to be ready for this. So when we saw the fire, I was watching it from my porch. I called my team, and we instantly went down and got all of our equipment from the office, the Red Cross office, and got over to the middle school, and we were set up and ready to accept anyone who needed sheltering by 10:45.
Mm-hmm. And I heard in the rumor mill that there was also the armory available.
The armory was actually over here, over at the shelter very often in case we needed more cots and things like that. But in a situation like this, this is our responsibility. They were trying to keep, as Amy said, keep the roads clear. And we got some, social media was an interesting added challenge for this particular disaster. And even word from the armory, some of the members of the armory were that, at 1:30 in the morning they came in and said, there's a bus full of people on their way to the shelter, be ready. And that never happened. So a lot of rumor mills, obviously, and that's why it's so important in a situation like this to only not to talk and, post things on Facebook. We had 8 people check into the shelter that evening. Only 2 ended up staying because families or friends in town called them after they checked in and offered to let them stay there. A lot of shock and awe and people not knowing what to do. It's very difficult for a person to leave their homes and all their belongings behind and just hope for the best. And so we were ready with a nurse, a physician, a counselor. We had 75 cots set up. We were in touch with people that could provide food. Now, at that point, at 11:30 at night, food wasn't an issue until breakfast, probably, but we were ready for that, and we stayed open until we were informed by Amy at about 6:30 the next day that there was no property or life damage at risk anymore. So now, one thing I would like to remind the community is that this thing isn't over, and James will talk about that, but there are still needs in the community, not just for family who lost their home, but we need to support the Division of Forestry here with food, continued food, and I am a contact for that right now. So, we've got some things in the works, but and a lot of people have stepped up. I had 37 people at the shelter by midnight ready to do whatever I asked them to do. So the school district administrators were amazing, very supportive. Most of them stayed all night. Ron Bryant was there all night. I mean, most of them stayed till at least 3, but Ron was there all night. So amazing support there. I'm very impressed with the school district administration.
In your knowledge, what did the majority of Chiniac residents do, and the people who had houses there, did they go to friends? Did they stay around to guard their house and see if they could do something about the fire? So in your experience, what are the various stories you've heard?
Well, I can try and answer that. We, as far as we know, people were really cooperative. They called into that number. They said there are 5 of us in our family or whatever, and we're safe and we're staying with relatives or whatever the case might be. So they were really responsive to that type of outreach, and then we had a city staff that actually called people that they knew in Chiniac as well to ask them, are you okay? Some people chose not to evacuate. They said, I think that our house is safe for the time being. That's always a risk, but it certainly is each individual's right to do so. Hopefully I addressed that. Not sure. Maybe Catherine might have more to add.
Several of the families that checked in with the shelter, one of them needed translation services, so we were able to get someone on the phone to help translate them. And they were just checking in with us to tell, because they didn't understand language barrier, what to call, who to call. So they called. They did get middle school out of it, so they came to check in. And so we called the number to check in for them on their behalf. And they had a family to stay with in town. So they didn't actually check in. 3 couples checked in and then left later. And then, like I said, one stayed in, mostly because they weren't going to go anywhere. Their dogs couldn't be with them, and I totally get that. So we did have a relationship with the Humane Society here, and we had facilities and food and things for the dogs and cats and any animals that were brought in. Obviously, horses would have been a challenge, and that was one of the concerns, because in a place like Chiniac, a lot of people have horses, but that was pretty much the animal thing was what kept the one family at the shelter, and we were able to keep them with their dogs in a private room. So,
were you surprised that more people didn't show up?
I was. I was surprised that people are saying all these buses are coming back empty, and I was worried at the time that many people, because they will stay back and try to protect their belongings. And it was a challenge. The communication, we'll be working on this. This was a great experience, and we'll be working with the city to continue to be better at this in the future. I was getting calls in the middle of the night wanting to know what the weather was like, and I didn't even know what time it was. It was day or night. But this was a great experience, a great opportunity for us to figure out what we need to be prepared for in the future. And the thing to remember also is there are very few of us active respondents here. And if this had been a tsunami or an earthquake where all of us, or I was dead, God forbid, we need more volunteers.
Hmm.
Not just in a situation, because we have to be prepared up front for it.
Jim, can you give us an update on how on top of the fire we are at this point, and what percentage is covered?
Sure, I'd be happy to give an update. The First, I want to say that the fire is not out, but we do have it 20% contained. Yesterday, we were at about a 10% level, and the containment means that of the fire's perimeter, we've gone around about a fifth of it, or 20%, that we've secured it to our satisfaction. We mop up, or we have firefighters actually walk into the fire line about 300 feet deep along the north end where the residents are, and they extinguish any remaining coals or fire that they find within that 300-foot band. And they are still finding some areas of heat at one end of that area that they're working on today. But they're feeling very good that the community itself is secure, but there's a lot of fire line yet that needs to be walked and managed to make sure that the fire doesn't have a chance to get up and start moving again. The fire behavior recently has just been smoldering in the heavier fuels, as we say in the fire world, but the heavier timber or down in the deeper thousand-hour fuels or the larger hunks of wood that tend to smolder as opposed to burn fast. When this fire started, it was got into the dry grass and other dry materials out there and was just fanned into a very, very dangerous fire when this started. Right from the get-go, it was very dangerous, and I did want to acknowledge the great work that the emergency services did when this incident started, that there were no injuries and no one lost their life at all in this fire, and only one out of 74 structures, one home out of 74 structures, plus the library was all that was lost for property damage. That was amazing on both cases, but especially important because in the firefighting world, as in most of our worlds, public safety and firefighter safety is number one, and there is no structure that's worth losing a life over on that.
Could you talk about the fire's beginning?
I wasn't here during the beginning, so I don't really have any details on that.
How it began?
I'll just go so far as we do have a formal investigator that's attached to the Division of Forestry whose job is to come in to all fires and determine where it started and what caused it. But that investigation is still underway at this time.
Okay, so it's unclear.
Yes, all it's right. Unclear. I don't know at this point what caused the fire.
Okay. What is a defensible space?
That is a point that I did want to get to, and I'm glad you brought it up. Defensible space is part of the FireWise program, or usually is associated with that. And what defensible space means is if you have a home or any structure that on your property, it's the space between your home and the nearest brush or trees or flammable materials. And what we recommend at a minimum is at least 30 feet around all your structures. You don't have anything that'll burn. No dry grass, no dry leaves, no vegetation that's dead. That if an ember falls out of the sky from a fire a half mile away from a wind-driven ember, you don't want to lose your house from because you had some dry grass up under your porch. So defensible space is the principal theory, and in practice that it generally works well is to remove flammable fuels that are immediately around your house and garage and where you have your vehicle stored. And that goes a long ways to minimizing the risk when a fire like this comes through your neighborhood.
Is that something that house owners should be doing right now as the fire is present around them, or is that something that they should be doing far ahead of possible fires? Is that preventive?
This is something you'd want to do before the fire gets there. The smart thing to do if a fire is approaching is listen to the officials and evacuate. Again, no building's worth getting hurt over or perhaps worse. There is a short fire season, I understand, here in Kodiak in the spring for a couple weeks when before things green up, you might have dry grass present then. And again, in the fall, you're going through a drought period here, apparently, so this is an unusually dry period of time. But whenever things are dry, even if you don't have a chance of a large fire incident, you could still have a small neighborhood fire. And again, tuning up your yard every year with removing the dry grass from around the edges of your building is a big step. It helps firefighters. When firefighters are able to get to your structure when a fire is a little more slowly moving, If a structure has defensible space around it, it's safe for the firefighters to take a stand there without risking their lives. But if your structures have forest right up against the side of them and dead stuff, dead materials or lumber stacked against it, they'll drive to the next driveway until they find a place where they can actually make a difference.
Is there anything else you could suggest that we can do to protect our homes in the case of another fire?
There's a number of things. I'd refer people to the firewise.org webpage or Fire Adapted Communities. Both of those, if you Google those on the Internet, provide information on different steps for preparation there. One of the steps I think that's probably really key right now, after the fact but yet looking ahead, is to have an evacuation plan. Have your key papers where you know they are. Know how you're going to manage your animals if you've got large or small ones, where you can take them and how you'll move them. But don't develop your emergency plan when you get someone knocking on your door saying you need to leave now. So part of that being prepared and being a fire-adapted community is being prepared, just as emergency officials were prepared to reach out and get people moved with buses and stuff, is to be ready yourself to get on that bus. Mm.
So the American Red Cross actually has an initiative that we're doing in the schools this year, and this is exactly what we're doing, is encouraging third to fifth graders to go home and encourage their parents to have a plan. We have a pillowcase project that we're working on in cooperation with Disney, and it's encouraging children to create this pillowcase. We actually give them and have them color it in the classroom presentation, and we talk about home fires and what they should have, things they should have in this pillowcase if they need to get up and evacuate quickly. We've had, in the last 18 months, the Red Cross has responded to two personal one fire and one flood. And so it's not, even as close as our houses are together, we were worried. That house was very close to the building next to it, so even a individual house fire can turn into something major. So having that plan is really important.
The program for children, when is that happening?
We started it last fall and got into many of the village homes, actually, schools, excuse me. We'll be working very diligently, and I'm sure that the teachers are going to be a little more open to it this year given the situation. So we're going into third to fifth grade classrooms, and we'll go into all the elementaries in town. So now that school's back in session, we'll give them a couple weeks, and then we'll start scheduling these.
Okay, so that's something parents should keep their minds on for the current school year. In Kodiak, when was the last fire of this magnitude?
I will take a stab at answering that. I talked to someone who grew up here, and they said they'd never seen that. We did have, we've had a couple grass fires that were quickly extinguished, and there was the report of a fire on, I don't know if it was Woody Island. It was one of the islands that were nearby to the main island of Kodiak that was extinguished, but we've never seen anything like this. And people that have lived here their whole lives have never seen a forest fire in Kodiak on Kodiak Island proper. So it's highly unusual. I think given all of that, we did a pretty good job of keeping things as safe as we could, people as safe as we could until the professionals got here. But it's a very unusual, and as Jim mentioned, we're going through an unusual dry spell for Kodiak as well. So all of those things combined, along with that enormous series of wind. My understanding is that weather pattern is something we usually only see in the winter. We were getting strong northerly winds that have lasted for multiple days. So it was just sort of a very, very unique situation. But given that, we need to be ready to respond in the future.
We only have a couple of more minutes, but looking forward, can you predict at all what's going to be the next step for this fire?
I did have one last message I'd like to share, which is the next step basically will be the fire crews are continuing to extend the existing containment lines, and their goal is to get 100% containment. But as it relates to what the community needs to be aware of, The trees that were burned by this fire that remain standing, their roots typically are weakened by that fire, and they become what we call hazard trees. In order to protect the fire crews that are currently securing the fire lines along the northern edge of the fire, the trees that are a hazard to their well-being are being cut down. But the message is, after the firefighters leave, there'll still be trees, you know, away from the road areas and in the woods that are still going to remain hazard trees. And they can fall generally with a wind, but they don't need a wind. Once the roots continue to rot, the tree can fall over, and you don't want to be hit by a falling tree. So I wanted to leave that message. There's another related hazard within a fire area, even though the fire is gone, is there may be an ash pit in the ground where there's a root system had burned out, and there could still potentially be heat and coals in the bottom of that. So I recommend take extreme care if you do visit any of the areas that have standing timber that had fire activity on them. So that's what I'd like to close with. Thank you.
Thank you all three for joining us today and updating us on the Chinook Fire. You've been listening to Talk of the Rock. Thanks for tuning in.